The 2005 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 332, a panel discussion entitled They Have Their Place, Race and Identity in the Mormon Church, with panelists Laura Bush, Darren T. Smith, and Megan Falater.
Welcome all. Thanks for coming to this session on They Have Their Place, Race and Identity in the Mormon Church. And I'd ask you to turn all your cell phones on because that's what seems to be happening in each session, and we need a cell phone chorus at some point to wake us up. All right, so wouldn't want to buck the system and have everybody turn them off. All right. I am the moderator, and I am going to go third on this panel. So I'm going to first introduce my colleagues, and then I will share my paper first. And each one of us is planning to take about 15, no more than 20 minutes, and then we want to make sure there's some time for question and answer. All right. So it's my pleasure to introduce Darren Smith, who I actually met for the first time last year and was so impressed by his session that I had to make contact and start collaborating with him, and it's been a great year of professional collaboration and a lot of admiration, I think, for his work and what he's doing. He's a doctoral student in the Department of Education, Culture, and Society at the University of Utah. His research focus includes race identity and the history of race and medical science and many other things as well. He's the co-editor of Black and Mormon with Newell Bringhurst and has taught courses in race at Utah Valley State College, BYU, and the University of Utah. Megan Falater, I've known almost about the same period of time as Darren. She's a very successful undergraduate student at Arizona State University, where I am presently teaching. And she's completing her honors thesis on the history of prison labor in Arizona at Arizona State. And she's planning to explore graduate studies after her December 2005 graduation. She's a recipient of the Dean's Council Award in Women's Studies from the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences at ASU and has really spearheaded this particular session, actually. So she's an energetic and I think going to be a new, wonderful scholar in the areas of race and gender. I am Laura Bush, the Laura Bush. I earned my PhD in English from Arizona State in 2000 with an emphasis in American literature and autobiography studies. Last year, I published Faithful Transgressions in the American West, Six 20th Century Mormon Women's Autobiographical Acts. And in my book, I analyze the narrative and rhetorical strategies along with what I call the Faithful Transgressions, which I'll discuss a little bit today, in Wynonna Willis Martin's text and a number of other 20th Century Mormon women's autobiographies. From 1989 to 1994, I taught as a full-time faculty member in the Department of English at Ricks College. I'm now a lecturer in Humanities and Arts program at Arizona State. So, let me begin with a bit of discussion about Wynonna Willis Martin. This is from a longer paper, and I'm trying to cut it down and pay attention to my time and glean what's most important today for us to talk about this issue of people of color having their place in the Mormon Church and what their place has been. The way that we've imagined this session is that I'll kind of ground things historically a bit, and then Megan's going to talk about Native American positions within the church, and Darren will bring us up to speed contemporarily. Wynonna Willis Martin explains and defends her 1966 conversion to the Mormon Church. In Black Mormon Tells Her Story, a spiritual autobiography written during a time when civil rights activists in the United States severely criticized the church for discriminating against its black members. In 1972, Martin publishes the story of her conversion and experiences within a mostly white church for two main reasons. First, she wants to educate non-members about her new religion, urging them to examine any misinformation or misperceptions they may have about Mormons. Second, she wants her new Mormon sisters and brothers to see themselves in her stories, encouraging them to learn more about black experience and cultural differences through the story of her life. Like many women autobiographers, Martin writes so that her life narrative can be of use. Within the tradition of Mormon autobiography, such a purpose often means a woman constructs her life story to inculcate Mormon values in her descendants, promote faith, and explain or defend various church doctrines, such as 19th century Mormon polygamy. Martin's autobiography repeats these conventions, but instead of defending the church against charges of racism, she defends it against charges of, opposite. Instead of defending it against sexism, she's defending it against charges of racism. Many U.S. citizens during the 1960s and 70s viewed the Mormon church as a white Western religion with overt racist practices that denied black Mormons full privileges of membership. And I'm going to assume that you know, in this audience, the history of that racism and the policy. Considering the discriminatory policies toward blacks in the Mormon church, many have wondered why, then and now, more than 25 years after the ban was lifted in 1978, any black person would choose to join such a religion. Through the genre of spiritual autobiography, Martin attempts to explain and justify such a choice. With multiple audiences in mind, blacks, whites, insiders, outsiders, and her own non-member parents, she chronicles her religious quest, attempting to answer critics' and supporters' questions about the circumstances that motivated her 1966 conversion. The relatively short autobiography offers readers a brief background about Martin's childhood growing up in California with Christian parents who taught her to fear God. She then moves quickly on to relating a dramatic spiritual experience that parallels Joseph Smith's first vision. Her religious quest ultimately leads her to the Mormon Church, where, despite her skin color, she writes about feeling loved and accepted. She also, however, writes about frequently awkward experiences she has faced as a black woman in a mostly white church. Determined to better educate outsiders about Mormons and to enlighten Mormons about black experience, she believes an account of her spiritual journey has the power to end ignorance, promote understanding among people of different backgrounds, and thereby remedy both race and religious prejudice. During the late 1960s and early 1970s, Martin recognizes that as a black Mormon, she's a new kind of Mormon pioneer. By writing, she stakes her claim to several significant firsts, establishing her historical importance. First black member of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, the first black faculty staff member at BYU in 1970, the first black person to attend Brigham Young University Ball, and the first black member of her San Diego, California ward. She mentions these firsts casually in her text, but the accumulation of them has the effect of lending her significant authority to speak on issues concerning blacks in the Mormon church. The collage of excerpted newspaper clippings, which I'm going to ask Megan to, rather than bring the book, I have brought just some key pages from the book, the front and the back cover. You can get this in Mormon used or historical bookstores, and you can see the excerpts. Megan, would you just, like, on both sides and pass them around so that you can take a look at how her autobiography and how she's fashioning herself, how the publishers fashioned this story. So the collage of excerpted newspaper clippings, and that you'll find in the inside of that little packet I put together, all with Martin's smiling photo and eye-catching headlines, intends to illustrate the media attention her life story and conversion attracted in the early 1970s. Martin also mentions that she's been asked to address a variety of Mormon congregations about her experience. Quote, "I've had many speaking and singing engagements since 1967 in Utah. In less than 6 years, I have spoken in more than 100 sacrament meetings and very close to 100 firesides, in addition to many seminary classes." One way in particular that Martin's story repeats and then revises the tradition of Mormon women's autobiography is by focusing less on representing a communal religious experience, such as that narrated by Mary Ann Hafen or Juanita Brooks, if some of you are familiar with those stories, and more on depicting her individual quest for God and personal identity. In fact, Martin's method of investigating numerous religions like a, quote, church tourist, unquote, and her dramatic depiction of a scene in which she claims to experience the presence of evil followed by the presence of God closely parallels the life experience that Smith relates in his first vision narrative. She even describes the influence it had on her decision to become a Latter-day Saint. Quote, "The thing that really converted me was reading the Joseph Smith story. It brought back to my memory my own very personal experience with the evil powers and praying within for deliverance and feeling the Lord's spirit of peace come over me," unquote. By telling a dramatic, faith-promoting story about hearing God's voice, Martin establishes her credibility and authority to speak as a Latter-day Saint to her Mormon audience. Only after doing so does she dare to articulate a version of Mormon doctrine concerning external exaltation with God that differs markedly from church leaders' teachings. Using italicized script for emphasis, she asserts, and keep in mind this is before 1978, way before that, okay? These two things, baptism and the Holy Ghost, are the only requirements contrary to popular belief for entering the celestial kingdom and being with God for eternity if one is worthy. Therefore, the priesthood covenants of the temple, which we, meaning black members, are not allowed at this point, are not really so crucial as popular belief dictates. Her deliberate choice to declare, in writing, that life with God in the celestial kingdom could be achieved exclusively by way of worthiness and baptism, rather than by way of worthiness and temple covenants, constitutes the most faithful transgression, what I define as a written valorization of her one's own individual authority over official church authority, in her text. Such a liberal interpretation of doctrine would not have gone unnoticed by her Mormon audience. In contrast to Martin's claim, you all know that that would be considered, it's contradictory to LDS church belief. By offering a transgressive interpretation of Mormon doctrine in writing, Martin's text becomes one of a number of modern autobiographies published by black members working for change in the Mormon church. And Eugene England has traced some of those autobiographies. I'm not going to go into that, but she's one among many who are saying kind of transgressive things and urging a change in the church at that time. Martin actually writes more than one faithful transgression in her text, I argue. The first one she includes is this one, and it's a conscious, explicit interpretation of doctrine when she claims that temple ordinances are not necessary for people to enter into the highest kingdom of God. The second one is a faithful transgression she does not fully control, but it is perhaps the one that's most important. This second transgression emerges by looking at the publication of her book in total. As a faithful Mormon autobiography, she purposely works to reconstruct scenes that illustrate the positive interactions and acceptance she has experienced as a black woman in a mostly white church. Although she intends to prove that the church and its members are not prejudiced, she also reconstructs awkward, sometimes troubling interactions she has with Mormons that end up illustrating the very opposite. These difficult experiences, along with the racially charged supplementary material accompanying her defense of her new religion, reveals the undeniable racist policy and racialized culture of the Mormon church at the time. Thus, her faith-promoting conversion story provides evidence for Mormons' sincere efforts to accept and love all people, no matter the color of their skin. However, it also provides direct and indirect proof that Mormon theology has not always been the pure, untainted religion that its members often assume or imagine it to be. I then go on to use Beverly Daniel Tatum to, in part of this paper, to define prejudice as stereotypes, omissions, or distortions, preconceived judgments that we all have because we're constantly exposed to misinformation. But prejudice, she distinguishes, along with many critical race theorists from racism, as a system of advantage based on race. Separating rather than conflating the terms prejudice and racism better reveals the iniquities and privileges that persist in American society. Tatum explains that, like other white Americans, Mormons would rather view racism as ignorance or hatred than recognize it also as a system of privilege. Defining racism in this way would violate Mormons' stated belief in equality for all. In her own writing, Martin resists labeling any misinformed attitudes or behavior using the politically charged term prejudice. I'm going to go on to some examples so that you hear a little bit from her text of these uncomfortable situations. Martin writes, for example, that she, quote, can remember one Mormon fireside in 1969 during which someone asked me if I would change my skin to white if I had the chance, unquote. Constructing a poised answer to the offense that this question implies about white skin being preferable to black, she writes, quote, with a smile on my face, I said that, Mr. Clean, Ajax, and Comet serve the purpose for many things. I don't care how much I rubbed with those chemicals. Nothing would take my built-in tan away, unquote. Then, using capital letters in her autobiography, Martin completes her pointed but cool-headed response, quote, no, I would not change my color from black to white because it wasn't meant to be. Each race should be proud of their color, unquote. Throughout her narrative, Martin characterizes herself as one who must often find the strength to exercise Christ-like patience and understanding as various Mormon characters communicate implicitly and explicitly that black skin is inferior to white. In this scene and several others, she depicts brief interactions with Mormons in which she is subjected to jarring comments or racial infelicities that she must continually recover from throughout her day. Such incidents correspond with what contemporary social scientists now refer to as microaggressions. Richard Delgado and Stephanie Stefancic define a microaggression as, quote, one of those many sudden, stunning, or dispiriting transactions that mar the days of women and folks of color. Like water dripping on sandstone, they can be thought of as small acts of racism, consciously or unconsciously perpetrated, welling up from the assumptions about racial matters most of us absorb from the cultural heritage in which we come of age in the United States. Mormon characters in Martin's book commit a form of microaggression when their racialized marks appear naive, ignorant, or patronizing, and ultimately end up subordinating another person, whether intended to do so or not. The, quote, vigilance and psychic energy, unquote, required to deal with the psychological wear on the targets of such microaggressions are similar to the energy required to recover from microaggressions that occur when remarks, behavior, or body language explicitly communicate hateful or demeaning attitudes towards non-whites. Mormon denial about their own form of microaggression is just as calcified and resistant to change as other forms of microaggressions against non-whites, because what people will not admit to, they cannot change. Furthermore, after such incidents occur, their effects can be far-reaching. I'm getting near the end. In a sense, Martin's life story itself is a restitutive maneuver. She writes in order to process and maintain the personal and psychic order she needs to adapt to her new religious community and also to re-educate its members. Martin's most explicit motive for writing her autobiography is to educate outsiders about Mormons. However, her narrative also implies another motive. She wants to educate her newfound faith community about the difficulties she faces daily as someone who looks different from the majority of them and who comes from a different background. The varied purposes and widely differing audiences that she anticipates reading her book complicate the way she negotiates and produces tensions in her own writing. For example, despite the autobiography's insistent message about Martin's newfound happiness, soon after her baptism, she begins working for the Genealogical Society, where she admits, quote, despite most people's kindness, my race did present problems, unquote. Because no other blacks sang in the Tabernacle Choir or worked with her at the Genealogical Society, Martin writes that, naturally, she knew her race might be a handicap. Feeling Mormon's over-kindness and uneasiness, these are her words, toward her, she illustrates those experiences by her dialogue with various Mormons. Characterizing the majority of Latter-day Saints as mostly ignorant about black cultures and history, she depicts several scenes in which they display hyper-conscious awareness of her skin color and their own lack of actual experience with African Americans. And I go on to detail that. The other problematic part of Martin's autobiography, in which she's both trying to defend against racism and yet it's an example of racism, is the ancillary material. And I discuss that at a bit of length in my paper that accompanies her autobiography. Essentially, her life story is framed by racist material. The final material is a common racist rationale for banning the priesthood. There's also material in the beginning, and I included that. So this text is a very problematic text, but I think it's very revealing and very useful to think about historically what are the vestiges still with us as well within Mormonism, and she's illustrating that very, very vividly in her text, and it's painful often to read the tensions in her own life narrative about her own experience, which I would argue is not does a lot of that has not changed today for people of color in the church. I'm going to conclude with this paragraph then. This undeniably racist theological justification for discrimination according to lineage and skin color is positioned after Martin's defense of Mormonism. I'm referring to this ancillary material. Its presence and content undermine her central contention that the church is not racist by ironically providing evidence for the very opposite. In such a racialized culture, perceived differences based on physical appearances constantly shape the behaviors and attitudes that Martin characterizes in her text. Mormon theology at the time, which espoused sharing the gospel with all people, regardless of race, while simultaneously enforcing contradictory policies that discriminated against black members, created unresolved tensions and racist notions of white superiority within Mormon people, no matter how many Mormons, including, painfully so, Martin herself, might try to deny it.
In the middle of the 20th century, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or Mormon Church, joined the numerous Christian religions working with and proselytizing to the indigenous peoples of the United States. The Indian Student Placement Program was the religion's first coordinated effort to reach indigenous youth. The program outed indigenous students from United States reservations and Canadian reserves to off-reservation families who were usually white. From 1954 to 1992, though some students were placed with Mormon families as early as 1947. Approximately 50,000 students participated in the program during these years. Indigenous school-aged children were removed from their homes and reservations with parental consent and placed with Mormon families who housed them for the school year. The program was a voluntary foster parenting system that provided indigenous youth with educational and economic advantages not available to them on reservations. Mormon leaders also formed the placement program, however, to shape the beliefs and identities of these youth. These leaders expected students to conceptualize their identities and even their bodies in prescribed ways. While this was the first program of its kind created by the Mormon Church, the federal government and other Christian religious groups have sought to assimilate indigenous peoples through education since the 19th century. Richard Henry Pratt, a veteran of the Civil War and militarized violence against indigenous peoples, founded the first federally funded school located outside of a reservation in 1878. He described his educational philosophy simply, quote, "Kill the Indian and save the man," unquote. In short, he wished to change the way that indigenous peoples identified by stripping them of their names, languages, cultures, religions, and tribal affiliations. His methods included physically removing his pupils from their reservations and their communities and altering their hair and clothing. In short, he wanted to change the way that they saw themselves and the way that they thought while keeping them away from the rest of their communities so they couldn't bond with the people that, you know, they grew up with. Other United States educators and policymakers from the 19th and early 20th centuries agreed with his goals and methods. They created a plethora of boarding schools and day schools located both on and off reservations and employed many of the same methods. Attendance at these schools was usually mandatory. Indigenous children were forcibly removed from their parents. The Mormon Church did not participate in these early educational efforts, but the Indian Student Placement Program inherited the legacy of these schools, goals, and methods. To some extent, the aims of the program are similar to those of earlier schools. Both encouraged religious indoctrination, both sought to change the identities of indigenous peoples, and both physically removed children from their families and communities. While the Indian Student Placement Program did not accept non-Mormon students, many of the placement students knew little about the Mormon Church prior to being placed with off-reservation families. Their parents often converted only in order to put them in the program. While the program is voluntary, most of the students really didn't know very much about the Mormon Church, and most of their parents didn't know very much about its doctrine. Some indigenous community leaders worried about the effects that the program would have on their children's identities. For example, Goldie Denny, the director of the Social Services Program for the Quinault Nation and Child Welfare Committee chairperson in 1978 for the National Congress of American Indians, worried that their community's children would lose their indigenous identities and names through this program. The placement program also imposed prescribed identities on its students. Mormon doctrine identifies indigenous peoples as the descendants of the Lamanites, a usually wicked population depicted in the Book of Mormon. Church leaders expected their students to identify themselves this way as well. White Mormons refer to students as Lamanites in literature about the program without regard for whether these individual students identified themselves as such. Spencer W. Kimball, speaking at a Lamanite youth conference in 1971 about Peter McDonald, the chairman of the Navajo Tribal Council, said, quote, "It pleased me to hear Mr. McDonald say he was a Lamanite. We knew it all the time, but we didn't know that he did," unquote. Kimball believed that he and other white Mormons who share his beliefs know the identities of indigenous peoples better than they do. Further, Kimball argued that these students' Mormon religious identities should be more important than their racial identities or tribal affiliations. He said, quote, "They are not Indians first, they are Latter-day Saints. I am not English first, though my family came from England. I am a Latter-day Saint first," unquote. Kimball's statement is an example of white privilege. Many white people do not identify themselves by their race and instead project the concept of race onto people of color. White people, since they don't think about their race all the time, believe that they are, in fact, raceless, and they can identify themselves in other ways. Kimball expected that indigenous students would do the same thing that he did. He expected that other people would model their identities after his own and, in fact, demanded that of students. All people are different. Some indigenous Mormons did identify themselves in ways that met Kimball's expectations. George P. Lee, a Navajo Mormon who participated in the placement program and later served as a general authority, identified himself as a Lamanite and explained, quote, "My experience on the placement program gave me my true identity," unquote. Ray Baldwin Lewis, another Navajo Mormon, similarly asserted his status as a Lamanite and argued that the placement program is an important component of the, quote, "destiny of the Lamanite people," unquote. These students believe that Mormonism helped them better understand their indigenous identities. Other students, however, did not heed Kimball's demands and expressed frustration with the program. John Benally, a Navajo man, noted, quote, "I am successful, but I'll never be white, yet I don't have a sense of being Navajo. The sense of loss won't destroy me, and I will do well within white man's society, but I could never go back and live on the reservation. The only thing I know about Indians I learned from books," unquote. Students on the placement program spent the entire academic year, including winter vacation, with their off-reservation families and only lived with their natal families during the summer. So, you know, in essence, they're living three-fourths of their time with their placement families and are only spending a few months each year with their actual families. They often have limited contact with other placement students as well. Siblings, extended family, and friends were separated from one another in this program because many placement families were only willing to accept one student. Tona J. Hengen noted in her research on the program that those students who could speak indigenous languages often did not live near anyone else who shared that language. Several students, as a result, forgot their languages because they could not practice them during repeated nine-month placements during their childhoods. It is not surprising, then, that any of these students might feel alienated from their racial identities or tribal affiliations. They spent little of their childhoods with their families or with their on-reservation communities. Neither were they exposed to urban indigenous populations. These students were isolated from their communities and from other people who might know what they were going through, in essence, which is very similar to what happened to children in boarding schools, or to indigenous children in the boarding schools that I mentioned earlier. Prescribed identities also concern the bodies of indigenous students. George P. Lee remembered that a well-meaning white Mormon cut his hair on his first day of placement. This man and other whites cut students' hair without acknowledging the importance and significance that hair holds for some indigenous nations. Other students lost their hair because their white families weren't willing to make adjustments for them. Ayun Yelajon explained that her foster mother did not know how to style her hair. Rather than learn how to handle hair different from her own or respect her placement daughter's wishes, the placement mother cut her hair so short that, in Yelajon's words, it resembled a boy's hair. This was really distressing to Yelajon. It was a part of her identity, both as an indigenous person and as a woman, and, you know, she lost her hair because of this placement program. Lee's and Yelajon's experiences are not dissimilar to those of indigenous students in boarding schools, where students' physical identities were changed so that they would be able to look like white people. Mormon doctrine also addresses skin color, though the particularities of what differences in skin color connote change during the program's lifetime. The Book of Mormon notes that one component of the Lamanites' curse was their darker skins. And if you wanted to look this up, you could look at, for example, 2 Nephi chapter 5, verses 20 through 22. Several indigenous students expressed discomfort and shame with their skin color and the differences between the color of their skin and the color of their placement family's skin. Kay Cox, a white Mormon author, noted that her 13-year-old Apache daughter bathed with Clorox bleach in an effort to lighten her skin. Mormon beliefs about racial difference and curses negatively impacted many of these students. And this girl tried to change the way that she looked because, you know, she believed that there was something wrong with her. Another predominant Mormon belief discussed replacement concerned changing skin color. Many Mormons believed that the darker skin color of indigenous students would lighten as they became Mormon. Editions of the Book of Mormon published during the first decades of the program included a passage in 2 Nephi chapter 30, verse 6, indicating that as the descendants of the Lamanites became righteous, they would also become, quote, white and delightsome, unquote. While this phrase is controversial and was not included in all editions of the text in the 19th century and is not included in the present edition of the Book of Mormon, it was accepted as truth during many of the years of the Indian Student Placement Program. Kimball even claimed that he had witnessed this whitening. He said in 1960, quote, "The day of the Lamanites is nigh. For years they have been growing delightsome, and they are now becoming white and delightsome, as they were promised." In this picture of the 20 Lamanite missionaries, and he held up a picture that I don't have, 15 of the 20 were as light as Anglos, 5 were darker but equally delightsome. The children of the home placement program in Utah are often lighter than their brothers and sisters in the Hogans on the reservation. Now, it is possible that these students actually did have light skin or had skin lighter than other members of their families. Siblings from a single family do not always share the same skin tone. Further, George P. Lee observed that he lost the tan that he developed on his reservations when he went on placement. He spent so much time outdoors on the reservation that he developed a tan. And then when he went on placement, he spent so much time indoors that he lost it. So there were changes in skin color because he developed and lost tans. It seems that Kimball ignored these possibilities, however, in his efforts to find proof that supported the doctrine that skin color reflects an individual's righteousness. The very bodies of these indigenous students were sites of interest and control for Mormon leaders as they tried to find proof of their doctrines. The placement program did provide advantages to some students. It offered them better schools in some instances and provided them with brief opportunities to live with families who possessed more economic resources than were available on the reservations. But the program and the beliefs of many white Mormons involved in the program were also harmful. Many Mormons wished to assimilate these students into Mormon culture. In this regard, they were not very different from non-Mormon Christian and government leaders who sought to change the cultures of indigenous peoples. Yet church leaders also sought to control these students' identities. It was not enough that they convert to Mormonism or act and speak in the ways that the white Mormons did. These students were asked to design their identities and bodies according to the dictates of Mormon belief.
All I can say is, good gravy. All right. Critical thinking means becoming a change agent, an agent of change, and getting at the root of something. As such, I will address three central issues that should be of importance to all Latter-day Saints. One, the dearth of African Americans in the church nationwide. Two, the ongoing persistence of racial folklore that remains prevalent in the faith. And three, the need to rethink Mormon theology in ways that are more in line with Christ's proclamation that he came to set at liberty those who are oppressed. And that's a Luke 4:14 reference. The lack of African-American participation in the LDS church is varied and complex. The reasons why some black communities have higher participation rates than others is dependent on a number of factors. For example, how well local leaders understand and are responsive to racial issues in their ward, state, and stake boundaries. In other words, how bishops, branch presidents, and stake presidents grapple with their own racial prejudice. I think Laura made that clear in terms of what that looks like, where their wards and branches on occasion have members of color. How do local leaders relate to differing worship styles? And how many church leaders are willing to deviate from the prescribed norms of mainline church services? You cannot understand racial differences through osmosis, and just because someone is, quote, human, does not equate with a universal experience. Some Latter-day Saints may disagree with me in this critique, supposing that the cultural climate of the church is welcoming to everyone and has open boundaries and differences. I served an LDS mission back in the day. The second area that I served in was in Saginaw, located in the eastern portion of the state. And prior to my transfer from Kalamazoo to this particular area, I had yet to see any black converts until I arrived in the Saginaw community. One Sunday in sacrament meeting, I witnessed a newly converted black brother raise his hand heavenward and shout in agreement with the speaker, "Amen!" In the black church, such action signifies collective agreement and works to unify the membership in attendance. And without such an affirmation, the speaker pastor is not sure if the message is being understood. The pastor receives his cues from the congregation, and they are quick to point out when the sermon is exceptional or boring, like many of you at this moment might be feeling. So if I'm weak on my game this morning, do not hesitate to let me know. Nonetheless, before I was converted to the church, my grandmother would take me to the Baptist service, and I remember the pastor saying, "Jesus died for our sins, so we need to thank him for everything we got." The congregation with one voice would seem to shout, "Amen, brother, preach on." At the time, I did not realize how affirming that experience must have been for my grandmother and for other members of her congregation. The only thing remotely close to it in the LDS service is in sustaining and calling church leaders. But even the gesture is passive and without much emotion. Okay, calm down, though. In contrast, such behaviors as shouting amen in a sacrament service would be construed as inappropriate or even disruptive. The bishop of the Saginaw ward suggested that I speak to the man about the proper etiquette of a Mormon sacrament meeting. Nevertheless, to say the brother was quite offended by the lack of understanding and empathy by the bishop's request. The man was unaware that he was doing anything wrong and was worshiping the Lord in the only way he'd ever known. The bishop visited the man, whom I didn't see again after that particular service. I just want to press upon you the importance of trying to understand the other person's experience. I think that was made clear in Megan's talk as well. These experiences are not universal. In the black church, oral traditions of worship are active forms of participation requiring a commitment of body and soul. This style of religious expression is so different from the white church experience, where many members have been taught to detach themselves from their bodies because such expression is thought to be irreverent, like the primary song, "Reverently, Quietly," assumes that reverence before God means softness, quietness, and stillness of body. We teach primary children to fold their arms, bow their heads, and sit still, which all signify allowing the Holy Spirit to dwell in the hearts. I hope that I've illustrated at least one of many examples of the instances in which worship styles conflict and members get offended and leave the saints. Such expressive behavior for many African Americans has enormous ramifications for religious devotion, and members of the church must be mindful of this fact. What is wrong with an occasional amen, clap, or hallelujah, if done when members are moved upon by the Spirit? Many middle and working class blacks in a predominantly white church may not feel as free to openly express their feelings of affection and love for the Lord for fear of alienating their white ward members. Get over it, sister. You now belong to the true church. It's simply not considerate and Christ-like. Given this apprehension, it is understandable that the testimonies that blacks in general might bear during fast and testimony meeting might tend to be more reserved and rehearsed. Indeed, the last thing that black Latter-day Saints need is to have their experiences devalued by insensitive white folks who do not understand the realities and burdens of racism. I think that one example was mentioned with microaggressions. An excellent example, if I might add. Nevertheless, black folks come to church in part to escape racialized criticism and judgment. For example, when a friend of mine first came to a Genesis meeting in Utah, she broke down crying because for the first time in the church, she felt understood. There's something about being around others who share a similar experience like you that makes the experience so much sweeter. Being black and attending predominantly white and conservative wards and branches and stakes can be extraordinarily lonely and alienating, something that whites take for granted. The overwhelming sense of loneliness pales in comparison with the moment that black investigators and members are confronted with the invidious history of racist folklore for the first time and throughout the membership of the church, if they stay in long enough. I first learned about the priesthood ban on blacks only after I was baptized into the church. Let me repeat that again. I first learned about the priesthood ban on blacks only after I'd been baptized in the church for a very short time. Needless to say, I felt betrayed. How could these people be one way and be another in the same breath, I reasoned. The explanations that missionaries gave me made absolutely no sense at all. One elder suggested that blacks were descendants from Cain. Many of you have heard of that, I'm sure. The Cain explanation, along with the neutral spirits and the preexistence, paralleled with Ham seeing his father's Noah's nakedness. What does being naked have anything to do with anything? Nevertheless, must appear strange and utterly ridiculous, especially to a 15-year-old like me. Yet these beliefs remain a constitutive part of the body of literature and rhetoric throughout the church, and it is not easily erased. Latter-day Saint racist folklore is one of the polemical topics that I often address in my college classes that I teach. I urge students to begin the process of evaluating concepts evaluating concepts of racist teachings by early Mormon leaders up to the present day. My aim is to invite them to better understand the burdens of mistaken racialized ideas in the Mormon community that were handed down from generation to generation and which they must reconcile. Trying to help my students understand the prejudicial and discriminatory attitudes that many church leaders held about blacks is no easy task. Y'all have taught them very well, if I might add. These young people and many active members of the church have been made to feel that questioning church leaders in any capacity is sinful. At every juncture, from the podium to church seminary, the lessons my students learn is never to question church leaders. Urging students to get beyond this racist mentality is incredibly difficult, to say the least. In the church, the racist folklore behind the priesthood ban, priesthood restriction, is an enduring truth that many well-intentioned Latter-day Saints fervently defend, even when there is strong evidence that many prominent church leaders held racist ideas about blacks that informed church policy. Let me give you one example of what that means. In the new book by David O. McKay and The Rise of Modern Mormonism by Greg Prince and Robert Wright, the authors were allowed unprecedented access into the journal notes and minutes of the late President McKay and his closest associates and their feelings about black people. Throughout the chapter entitled, by the way, Newell will be doing a session today on that very topic, so those who are inclined to show up, we will have a few things to say to Brother Prince when he's there. Throughout the chapter entitled Black Civil Rights and the Priesthood, you get a sense of the degree of how the civil rights movement was seen as a communist plot by the late Ezra Taft Benson, and how Joseph Fielding Smith's 1963 statement, and I quote, "Darkies are wonderful people." It would have been better if he would have said, "Brothers are wonderful people." "Darkies are wonderful people, and they have their place in the church," close quote. Especially disturbing were the racial views held by Harold B. Lee, who adamantly resisted allowing blacks to be ordained to the priesthood and fought with President McKay over building the temple in Washington, D.C., because he felt, and I quote, "There are too many Negroes in the area." Okay? Probably would have been better to say too many niggas in the area, but that was probably best to say that. Close quote. Lee also chided then-president of BYU, Elder Ernest L. Wilkinson, with a stern warning that he would hold him personally responsible if his daughter hooked up with a colored boy. And I quote, Lee's daughter told a friend, and this is the quote, "My daddy said that as long as he's alive, they'll never have the priesthood," close quote. These statements and racial ideas do not stand in isolation in church affairs. They become canonized in the hearts and minds of many Latter-day Saints and drive policy and decision-making. What disturbs me even more is that this folklore remains a significant part of the Mormon experience. We would all be naive if we would think that it didn't. Books by prominent Mormon leaders are still in print that proclaim that blacks were both spiritually and temporally under a divine sanction by God, teaching counter to what church authorities have written regarding divine marks and curses, even if patently racist, poses a challenge for all racially sensitive Latter-day Saints, challenging racist teachings, racist teachings, practices, beliefs, and writings in order to make the church better for everyone is Christ-like and consistent with gospel principles. We should not sit idly by and wait for our marching orders on this matter, but strive for change. Christ stood as the quintessential change agent. Christ radically believed in the liberation of the oppressed in ways that privileged folks do not understand. And I want to end on this last point. Okay, and this is why I propose a liberation theology, which starts from the position that Jesus is about those people he repeatedly referred to in the scriptures as the least of them. Theology is human speech, right, though? About God. It is the way in which we interpret God from our particular vantage point. Because the church is solely ran by members of the dominant group, it should not be any surprise that they do not see the issues of African Americans or women or Native Americans as any concern, or at least enough to address in terms of racially. In some respect, theology is extremely political. in that group interests are embedded in a theorizing about God and the nature of God and his existence or her existence, depending on your persuasion. Under the banner of the theology of under the banner of liberation theology, loving one another is truly cognitive work. And I would argue it's cognitive work in the sense that it takes more to love one another. We have to understand one another. And that might be a very painful process for many of our white brothers and sisters. And I think that the example that Laura gave of the Harris piece is very interesting in that what black folks in particular have to do to cope with being in a predominantly white church. It's not equal in that sense by any means. What I'm suggesting here is a rereading of Christ with a critical eye that requires us to deconstruct the literally hundreds of thousands of bits of information that frame our perceptions of the world, that enable us to spin Christ in the image of our politic, among other things, whether consciously or unconsciously. A liberation Mormon praxis means that we alter the discussions about a universal white church or white Christ who adheres to a strict regime of rewards and punishments. Good over bad, men over women, white over non-white, straight over gay, and above all, self-interest. It is sorely needed in the LDS Church a theology of liberation for people of color, especially blacks, which start from the position of the lived experience in Christ. There is a big difference between white Christian theology and black Christian theology. White Christian theology is very, very much in the same line as the Enlightenment phenomena, very much in the same line as rationalizing Christ, examining Christ, asking very, very rational, scientific questions about Christ, whereas in the black church experience, there's more of an emphasis on the stories about biblical liberation, the stories and struggles about black people living with racism and being oppressed. The anthropomorphic Christ has been made in the image of white, middle, upper-class Americans that does not speak to a liberation ethic in the same ways that it would in a black church experience. So if we're serious about proselytizing amongst the black community, particularly in American society, we have got to recognize that blacks do not share in general the same universal experience that whites do about Christ. Now, I would even argue that even though middle-class blacks tend to have some of the same persuasions as their white middle-class counterparts, okay, they represent a small minority of converts in the LDS Church. The biggest majority of blacks in America live in urban communities and are working class. And if there's to be any success amongst those particular individuals, we have got to change the way that we approach God in order to make it more inclusive. Otherwise, we're just going to be committing what I call verbal masturbation, or at least theological masturbation. Okay? This is not to suggest that church leaders are not inspired in matters of faith. I'm merely suggesting that black Mormons, at least those who join the faith and remain active, have found ways to construct an image of Christ against the backdrop of white privilege that was mentioned earlier, which is more suitable to the lived experience of blacks than to this sort of anthropomorphized notion of Christ as white. Living with racism and class oppression tends to bring those who are considered the least of them into Christianity and to other faith traditions. And as I indicated before, if we're serious about proselytizing black folks, primarily working class blacks, we have to recognize those experiences. And I think the burden and the onus is on white Mormons to do that very, very serious work. And by the attendance of this audience, I don't think we're quite there yet. So we've got some more work to do. And I'll end on that. Thank you.
So will you please come to the microphone to ask your questions?
Darren, many years ago, I was a member of the ministerial staff of a black church down in South Central Los Angeles. And the minister, Brother Taylor, is his name, just call me Brother, said, told me a story that I think brought to mind that from what you just said. He had been invited to give us a sermon to a large black congregation in Pennsylvania. And he had gotten into that sermon and got carried away and was wonderful, and audience appreciated him. And he said, after that sermon, an old lady, black lady, came up to him, and she said,
Reverend Brother, the Lord do work in mischievous ways his wonders to reform. And he said, he blinked at her and he said, she got it better than the original. I think we're doing that.
I'd just like to ask if any of you have thought about the role kind of, I mean, I see her in kind of a liminal place, Gladys Knight. Does she, because I've heard her kind of chide President Hinckley about, you know, we got to get some movement and some emotion here in this, you know, in our hymns and in our worship style. And as I recall, he made the comment back that, you know, teach us, sister, you know, something sort of like that. Do y'all, have y'all given any thought to, is she going to have any impact? Or not just is she going to have any impact, but what do you see her role as being in this, what you're talking about?
Well, I think that Gladys Knight represents a celebrity figure, so she has a lot more vision than someone maybe like me or some other black person who's less prominent in the church. And I think, and I've often heard that she has got President Hinckley's ear, and I think that that's actually a good thing, because that might lead to some significant changes in the hymn, in the hymnals, at least in terms of how we sing those hymns. So I think that can only be a good thing in the long run in terms of making changes and accommodations for those. I mean, we can't necessarily say we're a universal church. And this is what my students will say. Well, but the church, if we're a universal church, then we should have a single standard, you know, to bear on converse. My students would say that. Now, that poses some significant challenges and problems for indigenous populations or either urban populations that are converting to the church, that we're going to have to learn to reconcile that in some particular way. But I think that in light of Gladys Knight, I hope that she has President Hinckley's ear, and I'm waiting anxiously to see the fruits of that, those conversations that I'm not privy to.
But you do have hope then. You don't
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm not a doomsdayer. Despite what a lot of folks might think about my rhetoric, I do have hope that things will change. But I think that sometimes you have to go about that pushing folks. Otherwise, they won't do it, or they'll do it when they get good and well ready.
Well, she's pretty pushy.
Yes, she is. She is. But she has a whole lot of celebrity, too, and that helps a lot. Yeah, it helps a lot.
Can I just mention one thing, too? I don't have actually a lot of comment on that, but I think of somebody who I was hopeful about when I was still active in the church was Chieko Okazaki, who was not necessarily the celebrity figure, but she was among Mormons to me, and as a Mormon woman, she held out some hope for me to spread and push that issue of diversity and how we see people in varying cultures. I think she's had some influence, but there's a way in which I think Darren mentioned that it's white folks who have to be involved in this project much more than simply people of color, one or two here and there pushing the leaders. As long as it's just one or two of them saying something, nothing is going to happen. It takes white people to make that change too, to say there's something wrong here, there's something at issue, I want to learn more about this, and that Gladys Knight just doesn't become exoticized too, and what she does.
Newell,
but it didn't. No. I would encourage you to come to the microphone. I know it's awkward, but we're a small group, and I would like to get this on tape.
Yeah, I just looking at the issue of race and the diversity in the church. I've been studying this issue for many, many years, and I really have to thank Darren for getting me back in, I guess reactivating me on this issue, because this issue that I sort of strayed from and came back in on, and this problem of diversity of pulling in more people of color is a very real one, and I think it might be reaching some kind of a critical point. I don't know how many of you read this series that they did in the Tribune about how the demographics are changing within Mormonism. The number of converts is actually not only leveling off, but perhaps the rate of conversion is actually moving in the other direction. And I feel like that might be an element, not just in the United States. I mean, in the United States has been pretty flatlined, but even I'm speaking about what's going on outside the United States, the you know, in third world countries and countries where you have people of color in Latin America, in the Far East and so forth. And the churches, and I don't know if you know, how many read that article or saw that series? I think it's a very important series, and I really urge you to seek it out, because what it does is also points out how the LDS church is not the fastest growing American indigenous church abroad. The churches that are enjoying the fastest rate of growth today are the Pentecostals, the Seventh-day Adventists, and the Jehovah's Witnesses. They are all enjoying greater rates of growth. And I've just recently gone into a comparative study looking at the issues of race and ethnicity. I've talked with Darren. Darren and I bounced off ideas on this, and I was talking to Laura at breakfast about what I'm doing in that regard. And they've been able to do much better among people of color in other countries, and they're converting more people, and I think part of it is because they don't have the deep racist heritage, the problems with race and ethnicity that have been so central to Mormonism. The LDS Church is in a much more difficult position in trying to jettison those racist or racialist, if I want to use Armin Moss's more germane or more gentle phrase, of jettisoning those beliefs. And I think, you know, I think Latter-day Saints at the highest levels would do well to see what the Pentecostals, what the Seventh-day Adventists, and what the Jehovah's Witnesses are doing right, to be able to, for example, the Jehovah's Witnesses, a majority of their membership is colored worldwide. And even with the United States, I think they're approaching 50% of Jehovah's Witnesses are African-American. And that started out as a white religion, just like Mormonism did. And the same is true with the Seventh-day Adventists. I guess that's all I should say. I didn't mean to try to get up here and give another paper. But those are just some observations that I've seen.
You have my permission, Dr. Bringhurst, to give any commentary you want to. Yeah, it's interesting because I think as I research this as well and look at primarily the white evangelical church and looking at the differences between that and Mormonism, some very interesting patterns emerge. I mean, there's some amazing similarities between that experience and our experience in terms of the conservatism, the rationalizing and theologizing and so on. But interestingly enough, I think that analysis of looking at or not having a sustained folklore, racist folklore, is critical. And also the fact that the Pentecostals seem to have similar cultural sermonic styles that is very, very dissimilar to our tradition has a lot to do with that too. So we could learn a lot from that, but I don't know if it'll happen anytime soon. Maybe it will, but I'm hopeful it will.
What about their leadership? What about their leadership in these other churches? Do they have more people of color?
Yes, they do.
In the leadership?
Yeah, they do.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you feel much change is going to happen if there are not leaders of color in the church? Do you think the change can happen if it continues on this white leadership continuum that it's been on for years and years?
Well, as a woman who's the church is governed by male leadership, no, it doesn't feel like, until you get people at all levels of an organization that reflect the makeup of the organization, then things are going to stay very much the same. And so if you only have some token people of color, Helvecchio Martinez was a black general authorities, who's now emeritus from Brazil. And he wrote an autobiography also that was part of this hopeful and supposed change. And I think that there have been important remarks by people of color, but I think that it is, again, I just repeat, it's the general membership of the church that has to feel this change. I'm very curious. I know as a presenter, I'm not supposed to maybe ask questions, but there are so few of us here. And I noticed there were very few in Newell's session also on race. This seems to be not an issue, unfortunately, in many ways, even among intellectuals right now, that it's that there's much interest in right now because the 1978. So I'm interested in why you all came. I know there are some excellent competing sessions here, and we all have to, you know, prioritize our interests, but this must be a priority for you. So I'd be interested in how and why you came here, what you're interested in, and if you'd be willing to come to the microphone and mention that, and if you have a question as well, please do. After him. Go ahead.
I'm very reluctant to come to the microphone. I know virtually nothing about the black culture, but I'm surprised to hear you don't have anybody from the Oriental culture. My son just married about 3 years ago, a mainland Chinese girl. She's adapted very well to the boredom of the boredom of Mormon services. And whoever converted you, I tell anybody who joins the Mormon church, that's the first kind of character they got to develop to tolerate boredom and a great deal of boredom. One thing I have been extremely fascinated with in this area is the Chinese ward. Now, that's a really an impressive ward. I must tell you a story that brings tears to my eyes. We're a very tolerant family. My kids were reared in Asia. Now, they were a minority, a distinct minority. And throughout most of my life, I felt like I'd been a minority and discriminated against. I can tell you whole stories of being a Mormon, how I have been discriminated against in the Foreign Service, at university seeking jobs, particularly at USC. And I keep that to myself, and I've watched the Jews very carefully. How have they dealt with discrimination? But one of the interesting things that I thought at the Chinese ward, to adapt to the culture, because in Chinese culture, food is everything. I saw an interesting clash of culture the other day. There was this brilliant Chinese pianist that was in town. I don't know if any of you knew about him, a young man. Just an unbelievable pianist, 19 years old. So the Chinese ward joined another ward on to have a all kind of listen to him and hear him play the piano and the like. And it was a potluck dinner. The Anglo ward brought, as you'd expect, all cake and cookies and everything else, but the Chinese ward put out a full banquet because of the importance of food. Well, my daughter-in-law decided without any persuasion from me or anyone in the family, she wanted to join the church. And her parents were there. They do not speak English. And they went through all of the discussions. And thus, her mother and her father and my daughter-in-law were all baptized on a Sunday. And in the same Sunday, my only grandson out of this union was also blessed and given a name. And after it was over, and this is on a Sunday, the whole ward was there. And they had one huge banquet. I've never been to a baptism where they celebrated so much in a banquet. And those Chinese people have been able to adapt into their services, many Chinese cultures. Well, Chinese have got so much tradition, it's unbelievable. My daughter-in-law couldn't go out of the house for 30 days after the birth of the baby. When the baby was 30 days old, they had a huge party for her, the baby at the ward, a banquet. I've been in Hawaii. The church has been very successful in dealing with the people of color, with the Hawaiians and the Polynesian people. And if you don't believe it, at Laiea, I lived out there for a year as a senior scholar at the Institute Advanced Projects in Hawaii, and I'm just amazing how the services there have changed. As you know, if you've been to everyone, aloha! And they get up, aloha. Lays are passed out. And it's a different thing. And so my knowledge is the church has been amazingly adaptable in Indonesian. I used to notice how they sang, even though they were, I was fascinated. I wish I was a musicologist. They sing the Mormon hymns, but it was not sung like Mormon hymns are sung in primary. Count your many blessings, and the way those kids banged out there and the rhythm and everything, count your many blessings. First of all, I said, that can't be count your many blessings. And I know Indonesian very well, incidentally. I know that better than I probably know English as a foreign language. But I do think that we have some problems in relating to the black culture. In my ward in Anchorage, there was a whole family converted, and the church should all out to keep them in the fold. They did everything, Boy Scouts and everything. I've been gone. I live in Anchorage most of the time. I come back and I said, where are they? And they vanished. And my heart, I felt sad about it. I really did feel very sad. But I do think the church is doing a better job in many cultures than we realize.
Thank you. I'm going to keep going a little bit. I want to respond a little bit to that. I think one of the comments that you made was that you too have been a target of prejudice and racism, and I think all of us have been, in one way, some part of our identity at some point has been targeted. Some identities, though, are more apparent than other identities. People of color, of course, the identity that they are the target of prejudice for is right there on their face. So I can pass as a non-Mormon and avoid discriminatory behavior in all sorts of ways, right? And so I can move away. Right. Right. No. And there. Yes, there are ways that can happen. But I think also I've had. There are many ways that we could talk about how and why certain cultures are able to adapt to other cultures and why that's so. I'm going to keep this moving along. I did ask this question, so I want to hear from as many of you as, but let's keep going along.
My answer to Laura's question of why am I here is that as an active Latter-day Saint, I feel an obligation to pass to my children a healthy religion by emphasizing the best parts of my religious community and excising the worst. And our racial folklore and some of the related lineage thinking is part of that. So that explains my interest. And then just briefly, let me suggest one of the reasons, a related question you had is, why isn't there a greater level of interest in this topic, which seems to fascinate all of us, both for academic and personal reasons? And I think part of that is explained by demographics. There are just so few black members in the church that when I talk to white members of the church, they don't have typically any experience with anyone who's experienced the microaggressions. Their ward doesn't have any black people. And so when they read an article about racial folklore in the church, it's hard to convince them to understand that it's an ongoing issue. So part of it is simply demographics.
Thanks, Sterling. Sterling's the man. So talking about somebody who's doing something about something. So Sterling is active in this process. So we need more white allies like Sterling out there who's doing some good things for the community. But I think that even though whites have not had the up close and personal contact with blacks, that specific culture doesn't necessarily mean that they haven't been exposed to the stereotypes and the racialized messages that have been so much a part of the media and folklore and stories about experiences with blacks. And I think that one of the ways that we can sort of deal with this issue, and I guess I can say this, is that middle-class blacks have had more success in general in the church than working-class blacks for obvious reasons, right? Middle-class blacks tend to relate to middle-class whites. So there's sort of an equal status relationship there that's important in that experience. Working-class blacks, if they come into the church, will have more problems, only because there's a disconnect between their own experiences, their lived experiences. They're not able to sort of traverse the racial, cultural language epistemological divisions that middle class blacks are able to sort of succeed in. So I think there's a reason for that. So if we're going to bring in more working class blacks, we have got to be ready for that. And I'll say it again. My white folks don't like me saying this, but white folks have got to do this work. They have got to do this work. It cannot be. You cannot rely on Gladys Knight, Thurl Bailey forever. You know, and you know, you cannot rely on them forever. You have to begin to engage one another in these conversations and begin. And it's difficult. It ain't easy teaching white folks how to be anti-racist. That's a lot of damn work, because white folks ain't trying to hear it. They're not trying to hear this, because so much of this is about identity. So I really want to encourage you to do this critical work. You can use black folks as resources, other white folks as resources, but in general, the work is about white folks.
I want this woman to be able to come here, but I was just feeling my brother there. The thing is I think the problem is something that Sterling mentions, is that white folks aren't troubled by this because they aren't troubled by it. So it's not something that they're engaged in. So what is it that we need to do as other white folks to get them engaged, to see them that it matters, and that there are people pained by it, that it's an ongoing problem, that the problem didn't end with 1978. I'm going to get this woman up here, I'm sorry, and then I'll let you in. Okay.
I live in a suburb of Chicago, and on Monday there was a wonderful article in the Chicago Tribune about this issue. Kathy Stokes, a woman from Hyde Park Ward, had taken a reporter around and visited some Latino wards, and we have a wonderful mix in Chicago. My ward has a few black families. We don't keep them very well. I want to know how to do this. I desperately want to know strategies of how to do it. I have little kids in my primary that I want them to feel comfortable. I want the other children to understand. Anyway, I need strategies. I need to know how to do this work.
One thing that has been helpful for me as a white person is to read some whiteness theory, too. That's a new growing field. I can give you some references to that. I think that would help you as a person to understand how your whiteness may be even affecting your relations with people of color. And race consciousness, it's taken me a long time, and I still feel often confused and such. But that's been very helpful for me. What strategies, Darren? I mean, besides saying amen, I don't mean that glibly. I don't mean to make light of that.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Bush. I think some of the things that I mentioned earlier, and this is what this gentleman was trying to illustrate in his comments, is that it's going to vary from ward to ward, from stake to stake, from branch to branch, depending on the leadership, local leadership in particular, and how much, I hate to use the word tolerate, but how sensitive they are to the diverging cultures that they have. I think that's an important thing. But I think that looking for this is so hard for a lot of my white students in particular, because they want, they're relying so heavily on that enlightenment phenomena of the scientific method, right? There's a problem, we got to find a solution, right? And what's that solution? The solutions are so doggone deeply embedded. But in terms of personal things that you can do personally, is you've got to understand, I think Laura was sort of alluding to this, the sorts of barriers just being white, creates amongst people of color. It's not nothing necessarily, and this is another legacy of the Enlightenment phenomena, is that we are so concerned about individualism, our own ability to be productive, our own ability to have relationships, and this is not about you. This is about a structure much larger than you, right? Yet you contribute to the structure, but this is much bigger than any one of us in here. Now, this doesn't give a lot of people a lot of comfort, obviously, because we're looking for individual ways to make a difference. But I think that being open and honest and forthright with members of the church, people of color, is very, very helpful. Like, for white folks to come forward, because, you know, white folks generally think they know everything, so coming forward and in sackcloth and ashes and saying, I don't know your experience, right? I don't understand what it's like to be black or Asian or whatever the situation, but I want to learn, right? What can I do, right, to make you feel more comfortable? Now, my response to that would be learn about yourself, right? And I think Laura's example of the emerging literature and whiteness theory, which began with Du Bois, by the way, but nevertheless, is a good place to start. You're gonna see more of that literature come out, I think, even in the context of the church, because we are such a white church. Is it safe to say that? I already said it. We are such a white church, particularly in the United States. Now, that's not a bad thing, okay? It's not a bad thing. But if we're going to be serious about converting folks who are overseas and folks of color, then I think, again, white folks have to understand and begin to deconstruct these notions of universalism, individualism, what it means to be white, to recognize that white people do carry around a whole lot of privilege and not even know it most of the time, right? And that it would be very, very uncomfortable, and I do get uncomfortable at times, even now, being in a predominantly white church. Just my body in that organization, I feel very much like I have to behave differently, right, and not in the ways that I usually behave when I'm around people I feel comfortable with, because I won't be accepted if I really be hoodish. And I don't mean that in the baddest way, in a bad way, okay? But I mean it in a way that in the ways that I grew up. And it's interesting because when I'm with my friends of color, I usually wear two hats, right? I'm doing the W.E.B. Du Bois thing of double consciousness very, very well. When I'm with people of color, right, I'm black. Now, I'm troubling when I say this, because this assumes that there's an essential blackness, and I don't mean that. But there is a condition whereby blacks can relate to one another in certain circumstances, at least blacks who share a similar experience than mine. And so when I'm around those kind of folk, right, I'm one way. When I'm around white folks, I'm another way, right? And that is a tension that I have to reconcile daily. And Laura talked about this in the form of microaggressions, that whites typically don't have to do that, because whites represent the majority. Right, and I'm talking about the context, y'all who want to go international, okay, whole different ball game, whole different bag of chips. But in the context of the Western world in the United States, there is a phenomena at work that we have to get smart about.
I just want to make two quick points. I know we're past time, and I'll just make within just a quick
minute. How many more minutes do we have?
15 minutes.
Oh, we got 15 more minutes. Okay, then I don't have. I can be a verbose, but I want to leave time for other people, because I know there's some other people that I'd like to see who are in the audience that, you know, I'd like to see what their thoughts are on this. But, you know, I think just 2 points. I think that the only way we're going to see significant change, number one, is that more people of color in positions of leadership. I mean, I'm distressed by the fact that 10 years after the release of Martinez as the only black general authority, there hasn't been appointed another general authority. And I was really distressed at the fact that when there were 2 vacancies in the Council of 12, I mean, they did bring in the first, you know, the German fellow, what's his last name? It starts with a U, Dieter, I can't remember his last name, but starts the German apostle. But I really was rather distressed that they didn't, the second position that they filled, they could have picked somebody from Latin America. I'm surprised they didn't pick somebody from Brazil or from where the church is undergoing significant growth. And that leads to what would prompt the appointment or kind of reevaluation of bringing more people of color. I could go one step further, but I probably shouldn't. I'm also a feminist, and I really think we need to do more in that regard. But that's a whole nother issue, and we won't go down that road today. But I have some strong opinions there, but I really feel that the only way that we're going to get more people of color, that the church is actually, it's not, in the pressure from us, you know, is going to be insignificant. But I think what's going to really create a wake-up call is the thing I mentioned earlier. When they start looking at the declining demographics, they're going to say, hello, we need to address, how do we reverse this trend? We need to bring in, I think the declining trend of, of new conversions might be a blessing in disguise, that if we see more of that, perhaps that will be a wake-up call for church leaders to say, hey, maybe we do need to diversify, bring more people of color, more general authorities that are from other parts of the world, because after all, the demographics of the church itself, it's 60% outside the United States now, outside North America. Those are just the 2 points I want to make.